Hello, this is episode 21, and today I wanted to follow on from last week's podcast where we ended on how facial hair trends for men are established. So for those of you who didn't listen, of course I would recommend that you go and listen to that, but just as a reminder, it was from a paper by the appropriately named Nigel Barber, who found that beards were more frequent in years during which there were more men than women of marriageable age. This suggested that the attractiveness of facial hair is higher in conditions where communicating social dominance and maturity is advantageous, as there is higher intersexual competition among men for young, attractive, and fertile women. The correlation between them was 0.8, which was highly significant, suggesting that at least for that particular fashion trend is quite demographically determined and not arbitrary, as many sociocultural flimflamologists suggest. So for this episode, I wanted to continue this theme on whether fashion trends are arbitrary or whether they have some kind of logic to them and are determined by more kind of economic or demographic trends. But instead, I wanted to largely focus on women just because I think they are of greater interest. And in particular, I wanted to focus on standards for slimness, which has also been covered by Nigel Barber. However, before he began to study this, the inaugural paper on this topic, like the sort of cornerstone paper, the first one produced, was written by Silverstein, Peterson, and Perdue in 1986, who tested some interesting hypotheses relating to female fashion trends, particularly in slimness, and what it's correlated with on a more societal level. So they wanted to answer some pretty basic questions, really. And the first was, what determines these fashion trends? And do women's magazines just decide what these standards should be on a whim? Is it a kind of dialectic whereby some female sex figures, maybe actresses or models or whatever, decide to sort of undercut the competition by changing tack? So the rest of the population is curvy, so they decide to be slim and you know, vice versa. So they're just sort of undercutting the population and it kind of just goes back and forth all the time. Or is it less random than that? Well, that was basically what they set out to discover. So as discussed on last week's episode, sexually selected traits are traits which have been selected more often than not by the evolved preferences of the opposite sex, looking to find a partner with markers of good genes to have children or offspring with, and which may not necessarily be useful for surviving. And the possibility that women's bodies could have been modified by some kind of selection pressure making them more attractive has generated controversy for many decades now. And the main reason for this is that the idea is that intersexual selection, usually in the natural world, as Richard Dawkins famously pointed out, is mostly in the male side. So think of a peacock, for example. And the rationale is that because male parental investment tends to be lower, and the same is true in humans, of course, women are a resource over which males compete. So males are the desiring, not the desired sex. Because of this, they are said to bear the burden of advertising themselves sexually. Among humans, by contrast, of course, it is allegedly women who are more interesting to look at. And I initially doubted this personally because evolutionary psychology is hugely male-dominated. So unless an unexpectedly large proportion of them are homosexual or something, of course they are going to say this. However, the idea that they are more physically attractive is supported by literature, which shows that both men and women consistently give high ratings of attractiveness to female faces. But for this episode, of course, I said earlier, I wanted to focus on female standards for body weight and slimness. But before we talk about this, though, I want to discuss as briefly as possible the evolutionary pressures for which many of the features of a woman's body, which involve adiposity, fatness on the body, and the sort of evolutionary logic behind it and why they came to be established. So I just wanted to talk about three features on a woman's body that involve adiposity. And the reason I want to do this is because it's just to point out that slimness is idealized in a really tiny minority of cultures, because most societies actually prefer their women to be moderately fat, if not actually, you know, full on obese. And even in our own society, men see as an ideal a body build that is somewhat heavier than is preferred by women themselves. And yeah, so I wanted to talk about three of these traits, because it's just to drum home the point that it is actually quite unusual that some of these traits are not necessarily idealized in Western culture, and then go on to talk about why that is. So the first trait I wanted to talk about is called steatopygia. So that is basically just fat deposits on the buttocks of women. And this is probably the best known example of a body part which is synonymous with the concept of being so-called thick, with two C's, of course. And it is mostly, well, it is mostly pronounced in groups such as the Hottentots and the closely related Bushmen of South Africa and the unrelated peoples of the Andaman Islands. So if you don't know who these groups are, just think of Hottentots as, or Bushmen as being sort of, the only famous person who I can think of is descended from them is Nelson Mandela, who has the characteristic traits of a Bushman, or as they're called in the local culture, Khoisan. And the Andaman Islands, just think of them as the, if you've ever heard of a tribal people who threw, you know, spears at a helicopter when it came onto their island, yeah, that's them. They're very dark skinned and they're very sort of isolated on an island in the Indian Ocean. So yeah, quite hilarious. But some of the first main arguments on as to why steatopygia exists, it was on the basis of a natural selective basis, which was meant to satisfy the heavy energetic requirements of reproduction and lactation. So the idea is you have stores of fat, so you put them where it's kind of most convenient maybe, and then you can tap into it whenever you're pregnant and whenever you need to produce milk. But this argument is unsatisfactory for many reasons, because it is stored in a location that interferes greatly with balance and mobility. So fat stored around the waist, that's not a problem. It's kind of, it balances almost the sort of gravitational center of your body, and is much more efficient. So it can be argued that fat stored in a more conspicuous location to provide a clearer advertisement of reproductive prowess, that seems to make more sense. However, another natural selective process which has been argued, which I forgot to mention just then, is that it increases, like humps on, say, a desert animal such as a camel, it increases your surface area, and that helps to cool the body, basically. But if this was to be true, then it would only occur in hot climates, which is true with the three groups that I mentioned earlier, the Hottentots, the Bushmen, and the Andaman Islanders. So yeah, that is true. But the thermal ecology of these three groups is very different. So the Andaman Islanders spend a lot of time in water and have substantial subcutaneous body fats, which is evidently an adaptation for heat conservation, because it's found in all aquatic animals. So to have fat deposition in the buttocks of females doesn't really make any sense. And yeah, the second thing is that people exhibiting steatopygia, as opposed to increased overall fatness, would be short in stature, because if you need to reduce your surface to volume ratio and sort of cool your body, you would need to be small, basically. So and this would also be supported. So the Andaman Islanders are around sort of just under five foot. Hottentots are just above 5 foot, and Bushmen are kind of just, you know, on average about 5 foot as well. So these data indicate that all three populations could be categorized as short, but the role of height as an adaptation to thermoregulation has been questioned, and recent work suggests that actually changes in width are actually more important for modifying surface to volume ratios. And this conclusion is supported by the finding that there is no correlation between stature and climatic temperature, while there is a negative correlation between width, which is measured by chest diameter, and temperature. So although steatopygia may increase sexual attractiveness of women in populations, they also impose fitness costs in terms of reduced locomotion and in terms of efficiency of movement. So, and its expression is variable both across populations, so across groups such as, you know, Europeans, Eurasians, East Asians, Bushmen, etc., etc. So attempts to explain them as adaptations to local ecologies are not satisfactory. So all of these facts support the sexual selection model. In essence, why would you have something which doesn't necessarily increase your thermoregulation in a hot climate and also decreases your locomotion, makes it more difficult for you to move around and catch prey and just operate generally? The only explanation for this is a counter-selective pressure, that is a sexual selective pressure, to being more attractive and expressing your reproductive value. So given that there is a direct trade-off between locomotive efficiency and therefore the ability of women to contribute to their group's prosperity and to the production of resources, there's a trade-off between that and sexual attractiveness. This is particularly interesting for what we will discuss later about women in the Western world, as the standards for sort of curvaceousness or thickness, however you want to put it, changes quite often. And just with steatopygia, we also see a similar situation with the so-called hourglass figure. Now, I know we said that fat deposition in the waist is generally more efficient than in the buttocks, but I think we have the same story here. Both sexes see an hourglass shape as being the preferred female body build. Enlarged breasts and buttocks and hips, accompanied by a more slender waist, are seen as more attractive by both genders. As we just mentioned, there are two main components that I want to discuss with regards to the hourglass figure. One is the breast and the other is the waist to hip ratio. So we'll go through them both, because I think they are quite interesting. And I think the evolutionary explanations as to why they exist and why they vary are actually quite different. So we'll start with the breasts. I think they're sexually selected. One reason for this is similar to steatopygia, the mechanical costs of having such a huge weight extending out in front of the person. Just look at any long distance female runner to see that, yeah, they don't have particularly large breasts. That's because breasts tend to hamper your locomotion and movement efficiency, just like with steatopygia. And secondly, and more importantly, there is considerable within population variation in the morphology of the breast with regards to shape and size and length and that kind of thing. And I think as a general rule, naturally selected traits are going to be universal in any population because they adapted to that ecology in order to survive. You need a particular kind of trait, whereas if you're sort of niche finding and there's been variation in your ancestors' success to find mates, you're going to find a lot of variation within a population. So that's why within any population, whether that be in England or in Kazakhstan or in Bangladesh or wherever it is, you're going to find huge variation in breast size. So on the one hand, you've got this niche finding argument, which suggests that women are sort of catering to different men's preferences. So men who tend to like larger breasts, you know, they'll find their sort of market, and men who like smaller breasts, they'll find their markets as well. But another argument is just that it could just be completely arbitrary. And that's just fine. You know, there was no overriding selection for one type of breast. So it just happened randomly. But there is a very interesting hypothesis about the function of the enlarged breast. And that is that it involves a strategy for concealing reproductive status, because other primates have enlarged breasts only during pregnancy and lactation. So males will, of course, only mate with those with females whose breasts are not enlarged. So it's a sort of a signal to say to men who want to mate, don't mate with me, I'm already sort of taken, if you like. And so Smith in 1984 argued that proto-hominid females who were able to maintain these enlarged breasts through their fertile periods may have been more successful in monopolizing the reproductive investment of the father over a much longer period of time, because, you know, because she's showing her sort of taken status to other males. Well, the main problem with this is just that, you know, if you have, if you know, you're going to have checks and balances. So if you have one deception, then you're going to have some kind of natural selective process in men, which allows them to basically see that it's a lie, and that doesn't happen. But besides that, they're actually, you know, it's quite speculative, and there is no evidence that breast size of reproductive age women actually correlates with lactational output, which is the main sort of hypothesis for why enlarged breasts exist. So we can just sort of dismiss that out of hand. I think it's actually selective. So the second component of the hourglass figure is the waist to hip ratio. So it does tend to be obviously smaller in reproductive age women than it is in men, with, you know, with very little overlap between genders. So it is clearly very sexually selected in one gender, and that appears to be women, of course. But more importantly, this sexual dimorphism is lost following menopause. So as women go into menopause, their waist to hip ratio increases, and their fat deposition in their hips decreases. And what does this say? Well, it suggests that it is modulated by estrogen, which again suggests that it is a selected trait in women, and that estrogen is what actually stimulates fat deposition around all of these areas, like hips, buttocks, and thighs, and that sort of thing. Testosterone, on the other hand, tends to stimulate abdominal fat in the sort of abdominal region. Another thing about waist to hip ratio, or low waist to hip ratios, is that college age men and women of all ages tend to rate low waist to hip ratios as more attractive, healthier, and having higher reproductive value than those with a higher waist to hip ratio. Even when, and this is important, the women were depicted as being overweight or underweight. So the main thing to take from that is that, because, you know, there is very little intrapopulation difference in waist to hip ratios, and there's such huge difference between men and women, that basically it does seem to be more of a naturally selected trait. But there was another study in 1993 by Singh, which shows that a low waist to hip ratio is associated not with just perceptions of health and fertility, but with actual indicators of fitness and reproductive success. So women with a sort of masculine high waist to hip ratio, so kind of straight body and not an hourglass figure, were found to have higher risk for diabetes and gallbladder disease and various cancers and disorders of the circulatory system, and just generally had a higher mortality rate. They also had a higher level of circulating testosterone and a later onset of pubertal endocrine activity, suggesting the possibility of reproductive dysfunction. And underweight women having a high waist to hip ratio generally had their first child at a later date, a later age, and had greater difficulty becoming pregnant than did underweight women with a low waist to hip ratio, that is a more feminine waist to hip ratio. So in summary, the pattern of fat distribution indicates, you know, a more feminine pattern of fat distribution is associated with superior fitness in women. And it has also been found that this fat is used primarily during late pregnancy and lactation. So it is actually to the benefit of the child that this fat is developed and then used. And also, it also happens to be the time of greatest energetic stress to the mother, late pregnancy and lactation. So what does this mean? Well, all of these observations suggest that the waist-to-hip ratio is actually quite a precise indicator of reproductive value, unlike fat deposited in the buttocks and in the breasts. So men who are attracted to women with a low waist-to-hip ratio will therefore presumably be more reproductively successful, and such a mate preference will be promoted by natural selection. So that suggests that regardless of the standards of slimness in a population, of course, because they're sexually selected, the breast and buttock sort of morphology might change and the standards for them might change, but the waist-to-hip ratio will never change. The preference for that will always exist, regardless of whether the woman has a high body fat percentage or a low body fat percentage, because it indicates actual reproductive function and not just a trend or sexual preference. So that leads us on nicely to the question of why then is it in the West that these traits, even the sexually selected traits, seem to not be preferred, at least now? Well, the first thing to note is that that's obviously not always been the case. As you've probably been able to tell in the last 10 years or so, there has been a move towards a preference for curvaceousness in women. So then that begs the question, why does it change so much and what determines it? Well, let's go back to the papers of interest, back to Silverstein, Peterson and Perdue, who performed an analysis of the magazines Vogue and Ladies Home Journal, and basically found that the amount of curvaceousness, so that is that measured by the bust to waist ratio, is inversely correlated with economic opportunities for women, as indexed or as measured by the number of women graduating from college and by the number of women entering the labor force. Now, of course, there'll be those of you, and this is perfectly understandable, thinking that this may be confounded by the fact that women's opportunities and job opportunities have been increasing on a linear basis, because that's the sort of what the Whig view of history tells you, the idea that there was some kind of breakthrough moment, possibly in the 1960s, when women waved around their bras in the air and suddenly achieved more rights, and that's been improving since then. I mean, that is a bit of a straw man argument, but you know, you get the idea. And then you would add on to that that the fact that women's standards for slimness has been increasing is just a different phenomenon stemming from the fact that obesity is increasing because of overeating that comes from our prosperity. So women just want to lose weight. However, just looking at the graph they have produced showing the correlation between the mean bust to waist ratio of women appearing on Vogue since 1901 and then female participation in the labor market, we can see that there have been peaks and troughs. So you should be able to see this graph in the description below, but I will describe it to you just in case that somehow doesn't work out. So initially, you should be able to see this again. There is a peak of sort of curvaceousness in women in 1901, and that starts at 2.1. So the bust is two times larger than the waist. It then sort of decreases slightly to 1905, goes up again, and then has a massive drop all the way down to 1925, which was when standards for slimness was actually at their highest, which is very interesting because, of course, the 1920s were a time of great sort of economic prosperity. And, of course, then we get a rise after that all the way up to the start of the 1950s, when I think things were starting to get a little more difficult because of the war. And then ever since then, we've basically been having a decline all the way up to 1981. I appreciate it's only 1981. There's 40 years since then. I couldn't find any data on how things have changed since then. But if I was to have a guess, I'd say there's been a further decline all the way up to maybe 2010 and then maybe a rise after that. But I mean, that's complete guesswork. So we'll move on. So anyway, why do we have this relationship? Well, the authors hypothesize that it's because women tend to accentuate their feminine morphology when economic prospects are bleak. At least two different sorts of explanations are possible. So firstly, we've got the idea that entry into a male-dominated world of work may dictate a suppression of stereotypically feminine traits so as to appear more masculine and possibly therefore more competent. And alternatively, in times of poor economic periods, marriage may be pursued as an economic strategy so that when women can't be economically self-sufficient, they latch onto men for sustenance and for wealth. And this strategy may be facilitated by emphasis on secondary sexual characteristics. So either we've got, you know, we've either got a sort of pull factor towards slimness in order to appear more competent in times of economic plenty, or we've got a sort of pull factor towards just looking more feminine and just more attractive in times where times are more difficult economically. And there seems to be a lot of corroborating evidence supporting this, because the amount of body fat considered ideal for women is inversely correlated with the economic importance of the woman's work, their degree of political power, and their control over economic resources. So in societies in which women possess little economic wealth, body fat can be considered an advantage. And that came from Anderson et al. In 1992. And this is also supported by the fact that the same study, that is going back to Silverstein et al., found that women who felt that their fathers did not think they were intelligent tend to desire slimmer bodies than women who did not feel that way, suggesting that, at least on an individual basis, the desire for slimness is associated with concern about appearing intelligent or competent. So basically, it appears that curvaceousness is associated with femininity, and femininity is in turn associated with a lack of intelligence or professional incompetence, whether that's right or not. So given the possible effects of the slim standard on eating, found by another paper by Silverstein et al. In 1986, which showed that slim standards do affect eating patterns among women, it may be fair to assert that an important cause of eating disorders among women is that sort of association between curvaceousness and perceived incompetence. That is, many women, both at the present time and during the 1920s, exhibit more eating disorders because women have been considered to be less professional, competent, and intelligent than men. So women who have a more classically feminine body are, yeah, just considered to be less competent. So this finding may help to explain why eating disorders such as anorexia are more common in upper and upper middle class women who are most likely to aspire to professional positions than in other women. So this implies that eating disorders among women are not simply instances of individual psychopathology. They are, in fact, manifestations of a clearly quite a dangerous societal bias against women in professional areas. So to test this, Barber, who we mentioned earlier, published a paper in 1998 finding that men's standards for female attractiveness, as measured by the bust-to-waist ratio, same as Silverstein. Yeah, he found that that in men's magazines, such as Playboy, the preferences were actually higher than in Vogue, suggesting that the drive towards lower body fat is not demanded by men. It's not a male-driven sort of demand. And it's not even particularly adaptive in an ecology of sexual intersexual competition, as we were talking about earlier, because hourglass figures are actually reproductively beneficial. But it is basically just a spandrel or side effect of women's greater levels of self-consciousness about how others perceive them. which might be interpreted as a sign of women's higher neuroticism in general. This is a finding that is pretty well established in psychological literature, such as in Weisberg 2011. So another thing I was expecting to talk about was how gender ratio might affect standards of slimness, rather like how it affects fashion trends for facial hair in men or fashion trends in skirt length for women. But it appears that there is no research on this, as far as I can tell. So I can only assume that that gender balance and intersexual competition doesn't actually affect slimness standards in women. So we can maybe extrapolate further from this that curvaceousness in women is actually a universal standard, and that slimness is just a trend or pathology, even if you prefer to call it that, of the modern day. Now, so don't get me wrong, I don't think that anyone listening to this should then go on some sort of eating binge and just eat as much as possible and gain as much body fat as possible. That's not, I don't think that's healthy at all. And nor do I think it's attractive, and that's pretty clear from the literature as well. No one likes obesity. I'm not body positive. But all I'm saying is that there is no adaptive explanation for this sort of craze. It was more 10 years ago, to be honest, this craze towards slimness. It's not adaptive. It is probably more of a modern day pathology. I think I'll end it there. So as always, let me know your thoughts on this, and I will see you next time.